What happens when wind turbines meet wheat fields? Across Western Australia, more and more farmers are being approached by energy companies with big ideas and big infrastructure. But what does it all mean for your farm? This limited series from Farm & Co dives into diversifying farm income, integrating renewable energy into agriculture, a project sparked by growers just like you looking for clarity, opportunity and a fair deal. Over three episodes, the series unpacks the findings of a grower survey and explores what's really driving renewable energy interest in WA's ag sector, from the financial upside and long-term business resilience to the social, legal and environmental realities on the ground. Whether you're curious, cautious or already in talk, this series is your independent guide to navigating the renewables rollout. Welcome to episode 3, the final instalment of Farmanco's three-part series on integrating renewable energy into agriculture. I'm your host, Shannon Beattie, and so far we've explored why renewable energy projects are appearing on farms and the economic considerations that come with them. But beyond the business case, there's another side to this transition, how it plays out in communities. In this final episode, we're turning our attention to the social and governance challenges that come with the rapid rollout of renewable energy projects across regional WA. What happens when large-scale projects intersect with small communities? How are local governments responding, and what lessons are emerging on the ground? To explore these questions, we're focusing on the Shire of West Arthur, one of the first regional areas to actively grapple with these issues. Joining me are Chief Executive Officer Vincent Fordham-Lamont and Deputy Shire President Karen Harrington. Vin, Karen, thanks for being here. Can you please start by introducing yourselves so we can get to know you a little bit?
My name's Vin Fordham-Lamont. I'm the CEO at the Shire of West Arthur. I've been in this role for 3.5 years. And as a CEO for a local government in WA, my role is to manage the administration of the local government and I guess act as a conduit between council, who make the strategic decisions, and then pass those on to me. And my job is to action those strategies at an operational level.
And over to yourself, Karen, tell us about you.
My name's Karen Harrington. I'm Deputy Shire President for the Shire of West Arthur, a longtime resident of Darkin, a farmer and chairperson of the Darkin Hotel Community Project.
Vin, can we start off with a bit of an intro to where things are currently at in the Shire of West Arthur when it comes to renewable energy projects and how your shire got started in this particular area?
Well, we're a little bit of a hotspot for wind farms due to our proximity to the existing energy infrastructure in neighbouring Collie. So we have 6 different wind farm developers with potential projects for our shire, which makes us, as I already said, puts us right in the forefront of what's going on. It started perhaps 2.5, 3 years ago. I'd never heard of wind farm. Well, I'd heard of wind farms, but I had no idea what was going on until one of the local farmers rang me and said, I've got all these different guys from different organisations all wanting me to sign these binding legal agreements and confidentiality agreements, and I don't know what to do. And I said, oh, well, I don't know anything about it either. So that was our first advice or information or knowledge that there was something going on in the Shire. We contacted some of these developers and discussed the matter with them and suggested that probably would be a good idea and courteous to approach the relevant local government pretty early on in the piece. And we've sort of had on and off relationships with a number of them. And at this point in time, we don't actually have any projects that have a development application approved or submitted. But we do have 2 that have announced their projects publicly. And we have 1 that has had a development application approved for the erection of a meteorological mast. And then we've got another one that has lodged a development application for the similar sort of thing, which is being assessed at the moment.
Karen, how do you go about balancing as a shire what your involvement in this is versus the local farmers, when I guess it is their property and their land that these wind farms are likely going to be installed on if it was to go ahead, if these projects were to go ahead? And how does that balance with the Shire as a whole?
It definitely is a balancing act, and you do, as a resident councillor and farmer, wear different hats in regards to energy transition. So I guess, you know, everyone, landowners, councillors, people that live here in the community all want the same thing. They want the best for their community. The energy transition presents an opportunity, a once-in-a-generation opportunity, to set our town up in regards to legacy infrastructure. So obviously housing, water security, development of businesses within the town site. So I think, you know, everyone has that main aim, so it does bring everyone on the one page together. So, yeah.
Vin, what are the risks that we run if shires, and in this case, obviously, the Shire of West Arthur, but shires in general aren't a part of this process? If farmers everywhere are just working directly with proponents without having, I guess, that whole of Shire view, what risks are there if that was to be the process?
Well, there's a number of different ways to answer that question, because none of these matters are simple. I guess initially the risk is that it's going to create division within the community, because the Shire's perspective has always been that we're not too concerned about the landowners who sign agreements to host wind turbines. They're going to be remunerated quite well. So our concerns have always been for the rest of the community, or the community as a whole, plus the neighbours of those people who are hosting turbines. So I talk about the division, potential division in the community, because there may well be. So generally, developers will go to the largest landowners because they prefer to deal with the smallest number of landowners possible. So they'll obviously have an idea where the suitable locations are from a wind perspective. They'll look to see who the landowners are, who the biggest ones are. They'll try and get agreements with those landowners and then move out gradually and pick up smaller landowners to add to the total size of the wind farm. So the people who are big landowners are generally sort of tend to be the wealthiest people in the community anyway. And let's say that there's other people in the landowners in the Shire who want to host turbines but haven't been asked. So it's creating a little bit of a system of haves and have-nots. Mm-hmm. Then there's also, of course, the people who are neighbours of people hosting turbines who don't want a bar of wind farms at all, but they're going to have them in their neighbouring property for a minimum of, you know, 25, 30 years. So there's potential divisions there, and we've seen a little bit of that, and certainly in other local governments that's happened as well. Another risk is that, apart from the division, is that we're going to not have the opportunity to work with the developers to actually help make their job easier, because we know that there's things that we could do, you know, for example, identifying appropriate land that they might be able to use for construction camps. But we know that a lot of the processes that would be required to do that, like zoning changes and so forth, can be quite lengthy. So the earlier we know in advance about these things, the earlier we can sort of start looking and saying, well, we think that that bit of land over there would be really good for you, and we'll see what we can do.
Karen, with all of these possibilities of division between people in the community, I can imagine it's really important to have the whole community brought along in this process, and not just the people who are already in talks potentially with proponents about projects, but really the whole community. So how has the Shire of West Arthur gone about that process and just trying to bring everyone along on this journey?
So we've held a series of community consultations with the Shire of West Arthur residents in our town hall, and we invited along an array of different speakers. So we had developers there, We had experts on renewable energy. We had a legal firm represent their company and their negotiations with wind farms to give different tips. So people were able to educate themselves a bit more by coming along to those sessions. And in our second session, we also facilitated a number of different questions so we could find out exactly what communities' expectations were and what they hoped to get out of the energy transition and what their concerns were and where they would like, if there were a community benefit fund, what they would like that contributed towards. So we were hoping that goes some way to make the journey a little bit more cohesive. But going back to your initial point, it did feel like a bit of a land grab at the time for someone who was living in, you know, is living in the community. And because we don't know, there's no directive from the state government as to what the renewable energy transition looks like. So we don't know where the turbines are going to go. So all these farm owners have been signed up, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to get turbines in the future. So that can create a little bit of disharmony as well, that the expectation is they're going to get turbines, but maybe they won't. So the unknown is a bit of a sticky point, I feel. If we knew a little bit more about perhaps what the projects look like altogether, so if you put a drone up, what does their transition look like? That would then make our job a little bit easier in trying to assist not only the developers, but also the people involved in the transition.
I guess one thing that we haven't talked about, but we know is probably the primary thing of importance for developers, is transmission lines. So in order for these wind farms to come online and start producing power into the grid, we know that additional transmission lines are required. And so Western Power are having to construct or liaise with other organisations to construct a number of different transmission lines and power stations. But again, it's not very transparent and we have no idea really where those transmission lines are going.
And I think that's when the community pushback may occur, is not so much building the wind turbines and placing them out into the land, but the actual transmission lines are more of a visual impact, but also the unknown health side effects of transmission lines as well. I think that could possibly be a real hurdle for us to get over.
Then where did you see, or how do you see this progressing forward to allow for better, it's really multi-way communication, not just two-way communication, but between yourselves and your community, the proponents and the landholders, the proponents and the shire. How does this look better in the future?
Well, I think it, in some ways the horse has bolted, because we've already had the six different developers operating around here, operating from the perspective of, you know, trying to negotiate land deals. There's probably not much more room for any additional ones to come on board in our shire, so not really sure if it's a particularly relevant question for us. But in terms of moving these projects forward, how that looks for us would be, we really need to get the state government on board, and we don't want to bash the state government at all, but local governments and local communities have certainly operated very much independently on their own because they've had to. There hasn't been any guidance up until sort of perhaps this year, and that's where things are starting to change. I guess particularly after the state election, we are now getting some traction from government and government agencies that are starting to provide a bit of assistance. But if we'd had them 2 or 3 years ago, it would have made things a lot simpler for all parties.
When it comes to there being six possible proponents, we should say, for the Shire of West Arthur, is there any communication between those proponents themselves? Because I can imagine that if you've got six companies looking at potentially building turbines in one shire, that's potentially a lot of the shire that ends up covered in turbines.
Well, we can only go on some of the estimates that some of the developers have given us, and we sort of, I guess, best or worst case scenario, whichever way you're looking at it. But we've sort of had estimates of up to 600 to 800 turbines for the whole Shire. I did a few calculations based on what the amount of land that would be required for a wind farm for a certain number of turbines, and then extrapolated it out for I think I might have taken 600 as a conservative estimate. And it turned out that 52% of the Shire would be covered by wind farms. And when you think about it like that, it's quite a significant change to our landscape, which is predominantly an agricultural and natural forested landscape. So I recall at a meeting with a particular government minister a couple of years ago about this. And when he heard about the number of potential wind farms, the comment was, well, surely that's not going to affect your community at all. And I couldn't believe the lack of insight that comment actually showed.
Well, I think it goes back to being a small rural community and the potential for us to handle the energy transition. And I think that's where community benefit funds play a big role. So, you know, these small communities that are expected to host wind turbines and other renewable energy projects need to be compensated in relation to hosting the projects. So, and they do have to be significant community benefit funds. They have to be able to set up the community to keep functioning even after all the construction phase has finished. And I think that's, it definitely is a key area that's often overlooked. Nothing is mandated in legislation. So that's where we come up as a local government, come up in trouble essentially, because we don't have any leverage to kind of ask for the community benefit fund at this stage.
Can I just jump back as well, Shannon, to your question? You know, they'll say if you talk to a wind farm developer that the construction phase can go for 2 to 3 years, and it's likely that it would be 200 to 300 workers through that phase. But as you said, if we've got six of those, there's no guarantee that they're, in fact, we know that they're not going to be able to happen all at once. And even within some of the larger projects individually, they're going to have staged developments. So instead of having a 2 to 3 year construction phase, we might be looking at a 10 to 15 year construction phase. Because the other thing is, they won't all be given access to the grid at the same time either. And that will be very important, because that will determine when they start constructing and when they start operating. So we originally thought that if we could, there might be things that those developers could talk together about. And I guess one of those things is construction camps. Mm. We sort of posed the question, well, would you guys, if one of you sort of was first cab off the rank and built a construction camp, would you do some sort of deal with the other developers for them to use that after you? But it was all very non-committal.
No. And that's, how does a small community set themselves up to cater for that amount of people during the construction phase?
It's a lot of people that need to come in. You know, if you're looking at 300 people potentially over a 10-year period, but then those people probably just disappear. How do you again keep how do you bring the resources in to look after those people while they're there, but then, make sure that the community can survive when they're no longer there?
Yeah, because money almost has to be spent prior to the construction phase to start. You know, like accommodation has to be built, services to cater for the people that will be driving in and out, working in the town. You know, where does that money come from?
So to put things into perspective, the current population of Darkin, the town site, is approximately 200.
So you put in some significant numbers on top of that.
but don't get us wrong. On the one hand, that will cause, quite a deal of change and things that we have to deal with. But on the other hand, if all of those people, at least during the week while they were actually staying at the camp or whatever accommodation they had, if they were spending their money in local businesses, that would be a huge boon for local businesses.
Absolutely.
But as Karen said, we need some idea of when and where and what.
Yeah.
Because then we can be sort of trying to advertise ourselves to, you know, to open up more buildings or more land to attract more businesses here.
So the worry is that the bigger towns, I guess surrounding towns, will perhaps capture that workforce, and then the smaller towns such as Darkin will completely miss out on any economic developments that the construction phase may bring.
Yeah, well, one of our advantages is that we are very centrally located, but it's also has its downside because we're surrounded by all these towns, but all of them are bigger than us. So, you know, depending on where you are, where you live in the Shire, you might do your shopping at Collie, or you might do your shopping at Narrogin, or you might go to Cogenup or Wagen or Katanning or even Bunbury. So they're all bigger places than Darkin.
We've talked a bit about the risks and involved in this, which there are understandably a lot of. But I want to touch on some of the opportunities, and not just for the individual landholders, because we know that there is the potential for individual landholders to make a profit out of doing this, which is why they're considering signing up for it in the first place. But from a community point of view and from a Shire point of view, what are the potential upsides to developing, having these projects developed in the Shire beyond just those construction phases?
Oh, well, as I said before, I think it comes down to the community benefit arrangement and the ability to allocate money each year to things like housing. Housing is a real issue in regional Western Australia. So, you know, if we had that kind of money, we could build houses, attract people to live in our town, work in our town, upgrade our sporting facilities. A lot of our sporting facilities is maintained by volunteers, so extra money would help in that respect. Maintaining our pool, they're very expensive things to run, but really important in a small country town. You know, things like deep sewerage even. That is beyond our wildest dreams to be able to put something like that in, but is it a possibility with a community benefit fund arrangement?
In a best case scenario, what does, say, the next 10 to 20 years look like for West Arthur in this space? If you can write the script, what does it look like?
Well, for me, it would mean that we would have a source of income for the community and for the Shire to maintain and improve our infrastructure and services, and I guess to grow a bit as well. Nobody here wants Darkin to become a rural metropolis, but there is a certain size in a town that if you can get it up to there, becomes a lot more sustainable into the future. So that's what we'd like to do. We'd like to use the funds that we might get from these developments, I guess, to leverage maybe even additional funds through grants and what have you, so that bigger projects can actually be done. That's my goal.
Oh, absolutely. It's about long-term viability of our town. We want to make sure we're here for the next 100 years. And Shannon, as you know, our district has been hit hard by the LiveX transition. A lot of our businesses rely on that income, and that has now been phased out. So people are looking for other industries and other opportunities. And this definitely is a big opportunity, but it has to be rolled out right. It cannot create long-term division within our community. It needs to work closely with our existing agricultural industry. It's going to take a lot of communication between the state government, the proponents, and local government. And it is starting to happen, but I'd like to see more of it happen in the future.
Yeah, look, 90 to 95% of our businesses in the Shire are farms. So at one time in the past, this Shire had 3% of Australia's sheep. So, you know, we're very much agriculturally focused. And having said that, we welcome the diversification into other industries. That's a great thing for a Shire or an individual or anything really. But if that's the case, then you asked the question, what are the benefits? Well, then it'd be great to see some training programs set up so that, you know, if we've got people here and we've now got these new industries, then can we train some of our locals and keep them in the area who they may not want to be farmers or work on farms, but can they be trained up to stay in the community and do the jobs that are required once those wind farms become operational? There's a lot of aspects to this, and it's not just a case of, hey, everybody, this is the state's, you know, decarbonisation targets, and hey, developers, we're open for business. There's a whole lot that needs to come after that.
Karen, to finish up, what advice would you give to other local shires who are potentially finding themselves in the same position that you guys were in 2 or 3 years ago, and they find out that they have proponents knocking on landholders and residents' doors?
Definitely working in unity with other local shires, I find, has been really helpful. And obviously one voice is heard more than many separate voices. So definitely collaboration with other local governments. Educate yourselves. Get out there and talk to as many people in the industry, but also the people behind the science, so the educated people as well. Learn as much as you can about it. And just keep an open mind as well. It's something different. It's something new. It is scary. I feel it's scary, but the more you know about it, those risks, I guess, you know, they get smaller the more you know.
And I would add that you need to, either individually or with other local governments with similar interests, constantly lobby the state government, your local member, the opposition, various ministers, whatever you need to do to keep it at the forefront of their minds, because, you know, you need to, I always say, and I'm still saying it now, this whole transition has the power to be has the option of being the best possible thing that's ever happened to this shire, or the worst. Mm-hmm. And to a large degree, that will be determined by the state government in terms of its legislation and rules and so forth, and how it implements those things. I'm going to use a phrase that many in the industry use now. We want this whole energy transition to happen with us, not to us. And it's really true. It's nice and simple, but it's true.
Yeah, definitely.
That is a lovely note to finish on, Vin. Karen, Vin, thank you both so much for joining me on this episode. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Shannon.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Farmanco's limited series on integrating renewable energy into agriculture. This project is supported by the Southwest WA Drought Resilience Adoption and Innovation Hub through funding from the Australian Government's Future Drought Fund.